Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, today we're going to be studying Sutta number 24 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Ratta Vinita Sutta, the discourse on the relay of chariots. Discourse on the relay chariots. And it's named after the simile which dominates the discourse. Okay, this sutta opens when the Buddha is living at Rajagaha in the bamboo's grove. Okay, when the sutta opens, a number of monks, and the sutta uses the expression jati bhumi, which means native land. It's not quite certain exactly what's that referring to, but the commentary says that that is the Buddha's own native land. In other words, Kapilavastu or the Sakyan Republic. Okay, so a number of monks from the Buddha's native land, they had spent the rains retreat there. The rains retreat is the time when it rains heavily in northern India, which is usually from about middle July to middle October. And so after completing the rains retreat there, then they go to Rajagaha to see the Buddha, and they pay homage to him. And then the Buddha asks, who in my native land is esteemed by the monks there, and so on, in this way? And it seems to me a little bit strange that... Well, let me just continue. Okay, so then the Buddha describes certain qualities of what may be taken to be the ideal monk, according to the early Buddhist texts. It's one who has few wishes, few desires himself, who is not dominated by craving and clinging, and talks to the other monks, in other words, speaks about the benefits, preaches the benefits of having few wishes. One who is content himself and speaks to the others on contentment. One who lives a secluded, quiet life himself, speaks to the others about seclusion. One who... Here the text uses the expression aloof from society, who, maybe the word aloof suggests coldness and indifference, but that's not the idea here. The idea is that this is one who is very similar to being secluded, being fond of solitude, not getting involved in many social relationships, personal relationships, worldly relationships, and then speaks to the others about aloofness from society, not getting entangled in many social relationships. Okay, then one who is energetic himself and speaks to others on arousing energy, who possesses virtue, or these are the precepts, moral virtue himself, and speaks to the others about observing the precepts, one who attains to samadhi, to concentration himself, speaks to the others on the attainment of samadhi, one who has attained wisdom himself and preaches to the others about the attainment of wisdom, one who has attained deliverance, vimutti, or liberation himself, and speaks to the others about the attainment of liberation. And one who has attained to the knowledge and vision of liberation himself and speaks to the others about the attainment of knowledge and vision of liberation. These last five factors that are mentioned, virtue, samadhi, wisdom or panya, liberation, and knowledge of liberation. These five form a set, which are called in the text, sometimes called the five khandhas, which is similar to the five aggregates, like body, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. It's the same expression used, but it refers to something different. These are the five, call it the five outstanding qualities of a liberated person. That is, possessing virtue or proper discipline, moral discipline, being master of the mind so that one is able to go into samadhi, deep concentration, having fulfilled the training and wisdom, having acquired full, deep understanding of Four Noble Truths, dependent origination, three characteristics of existence. Then through the completion of wisdom, one has liberated the mind from all of the defilements, especially from the three asavas, the three taints. And then through the liberation of the mind, one acquires knowledge and vision of liberation. That is, one knows with certainty that one's mind is fully liberated, permanently liberated. So those are the five aggregates or five groups of qualities of the liberated person. But the Buddha is here praising a monk not merely because he possesses these qualities himself, but to complete his excellence, he has to be one who also proclaims to others the merits of acquiring all of these qualities. So he's one who has achieved the highest good himself and also encourages others and instructs others to attain these qualities that constitute the highest good. And so then the Buddha, to emphasize this aspect, in the last part of the statement, he says, he is one who advises, informs, instructs, urges, rouses, and gladdens his companions in the spiritual life. So this chain of words, advises, informs, instructs, urges, rouses, and gladdens, all signify that this outstanding monk is one who attempts to guide others and instruct others to reach the fulfillment of the goal. Okay, so then when the Buddha asked this question, the monks reply that the Venerable Puna Mantani Putta is so esteemed in the Buddha's own native land, by the monks in the Buddha's own native land, by his companions in the holy life there. And actually in the original text, when the monks reply to the Buddha, they go through the whole list of qualities again. That's the characteristic of the text. A lot of repetition to help memorization. Now, the reason why I hesitated before and thought this a little bit strange, and that is because, so far as I know, the Venerable Puna Mantani Putta was not a member of the Sakyan clan. He didn't belong to the Buddha's. He was not a native of the Buddha's land. So I'm not certain that the commentary is correct in supplying this explanation that jati, bhumi, native land, refers to the Buddha's own land. It could mean in his own native land, in the native land of the monk himself. From the name Punamantani Putta, we can know that this Punamantani Putta was a Brahmin, because Mantani Putta is a Brahminic name. And the Buddha's own native country was not Brahmin territory. It was territory that was dominated by the Kshatriyas, and the Brahmins were almost looked at as a little bit unwelcome in that territory. Or at least they had sort of secondary status in that territory. Okay, now this monk called Punamantani Putta was one of the Buddha's great disciples. And as I mentioned last week, each of the Buddha's great disciples is assigned to excellence in a particular quality. Last week we met the monk Mahakachayana, who is outstanding in elaborating upon brief statements of the Buddha. The monk Punamantani Putta was described by the Buddha as foremost in preaching the Dhamma. He was the most excellent in giving expositions of the Dhamma, not necessarily basing them on a short statement of the Buddha, but probably just on his own giving a discourse. Okay, now while this conversation is going on, the Venerable Sariputta is listening. Venerable Sariputta, of course, was the chief disciple, the foremost disciple of the Buddha with respect to wisdom. And he was also an outstanding preacher and teacher of the Dhamma. Okay, when Sariputta heard this praise of Punamantani Putta, he thought that it's a gain for Punamantani Putta that his fellow monks praise him point by point in the Buddha's presence. Then he gives rise in his mind to the wish, I hope sometime I'll have the opportunity to meet Venerable Punamantani Putta and have some conversation with him. And the fact that Sariputta is thinking this, to me, suggests that the sutta is being situated or set in an early period of the Buddha's teaching career. Because regularly, I think, as the Buddha traveled around, Sariputta almost always stayed with the Buddha. He was the Buddha's right-hand man. And I think often Punamantani Putta also would have been part of the Buddha's accompanying Sangha. So if this event were taking place sometime in the middle or late in the Buddha's career, then Sariputta would have known Punamantani Putta quite well. But if it's taking place early in the Buddha's teaching career, one could think it quite reasonable that Sariputta and Punamantani Putta would never have met before. Okay, but even though I say that the sutta is situated early in the Buddha's teaching career, there's a little problem that will arise that I'll call your attention to later. Maybe not a little problem, a big problem. Okay, so now, sometime later, after the Buddha has stayed at Rajagaha as long as he wants, then he travels to Savatthi. Savatthi is quite a distance from Rajagaha, maybe more over 100 miles. Yeah, it's quite a distance. There's a map on page 76. You can look at it if you want to get some idea of the distance. Okay, so after arriving at Savatthi, the Buddha stays in Jeta's Grove, his favorite monastery. Okay, and at that time, Punamantaniputta heard that the Buddha was staying in Savatthi, and so he decided to go visit the Buddha. And so he arrives at the Jeta's Grove, sees the Buddha, pays homage to him, and the Buddha gives some teaching to Punamantaniputta. And then Punamantaniputta sets off and goes to a grove which is outside Jeta's Grove, but in the vicinity of Savatthi. It's called the Blind Men's Grove. So he goes there to spend the day. And then a certain monk who must have known that Sariputta wanted to meet Punamantaniputta goes to him and says to him that the monk Punamantaniputta has arrived here and he just had some conversation with the Buddha and now he's gone off to the Blind Men's Grove in order to spend the day, generally passing the day sitting in meditation. Okay, and so apparently Punamantaniputta is still walking to the Blind Men's Grove. He hasn't arrived there yet. And so Venerable Sariputta picks up his sitting mat and then quickly walks off in the direction of the Blind Men's Grove. And he catches sight of Punamantaniputta and he follows behind him. Okay, so he's never seen Punamantaniputta before, but he must see one monk walking towards the Blind Men's Grove, and he knows this must be the one that I want to meet. Okay, so Puna arrives in the Blind Men's Grove, sits down, spends the afternoon in meditation, and Sariputta also sits down and spends the afternoon in meditation. Okay, then in the evening, that's the time when the monks usually break their meditation, Sariputta gets up from his meditation and goes over to the Venerable Punamantaniputta. They exchange greetings. And then he starts to ask him some questions. And now we have to remember that Punamantaniputta has never seen Sariputta before. And so he doesn't immediately recognize, he doesn't have any way to know who this other monk talking to him is. It could be, he could think it's just some junior monk, some ordinary monk. And so Sariputta is going to ask him what we might understand to be a very subtle series of questions. So he asks him, is the holy life, the brahmacharya, the spiritual life, He's asking him first, are you living the holy life under our Blessed One, under the Buddha? And so Puna replies, yes, friend. Apparently, this is some other indication that this sutta would have taken place in an early part of the Buddha's teaching career. Probably sometime later in the Buddha's teaching career, the Buddha gave instructions on precise ways that the monks should cut and make up their robes. So if the sutta took place in the middle or later part of the Buddha's teaching career, then the monks would have been able to recognize each other as Buddhist monks because they would have been wearing distinctively cut monastic robes. But in the early part of the Buddha's teaching career, probably the monks would make up their robes in different ways, conforming to a kind of general pattern, but there would not be a high degree of specifics in the way they make up the robe. So the Buddhist monk's robe would have been quite similar to the robes that would have been worn by other sannyasis and sadhus, wandering ascetics. And so for this reason, Sariputta, though he knew who this monk was, he's pretending that he doesn't even recognize him, he's pretending that he doesn't know that this is Punamantani Putta and doesn't even recognize him as a Buddhist monk. So he has to inquire, are you a follower of our Blessed One, that is the Buddha? And so Puna answers, yes, friend. Then Sariputta starts his series of questions. First I'll go through the series, then I'll go through some comments about the series. Is it for the sake of purification of virtue that we live the spiritual life under the Buddha? Puna says, no, friend. Is it for the sake of purification of mind that we live the spiritual life under the Buddha? No, friend. Is it for the sake of purification of view? I'll make it a little short. Is it for the sake of purification of overcoming doubt? Is it for the sake of purification by knowledge and vision of what is the path and what is not the path that the holy life is lived under the Blessed One? No, friend. Is it for the sake of purification of knowledge and vision of the way? No, friend. Is it for the sake of purification by knowledge and vision that the holy life is lived under the Blessed One? No, friend. So we have here a series of seven terms. Each one is described as a purification. And thus the whole series comes to be called the Seven Purifications, Satavisuddhi. Okay, now Sariputta is indicating or suggesting by his questions that he's not sure what the goal of the spiritual life is, even though, of course, Sariputta has achieved the goal himself, but he's just feigning ignorance, feigning lack of knowledge, because he wants to draw out some explanation from Puna. It's not that he doesn't actually know the answers. He just wants to see how Puna is going to respond to these questions. Okay, so when Puna answers no to each of the questions, Sariputta shows that he's puzzled. He says, how is it that you answer no to each of these questions? And then finally he says, what is the purpose, for the sake of what is the spiritual life lived under the Blessed One? And then Puna says, it is for the sake of complete or final Nibbana without clinging that the spiritual life is lived under the Blessed One. Okay, so the final goal is Nibbana. Okay, and now Sariputta asks another series of questions. It seems the answer should have already been obvious, that if the seven purifications are not the goal of the spiritual life and Nibbana is the goal, then it seems these questions should not even be necessary, but Sariputta asks them anyway. He says, is purification of virtue final Nibbana without clinging? No, friend. And so for each of the other purifications, he says, is this purification, is that purification final Nibbana without clinging? And the answer is no, friend. Okay, so then in paragraph 12, Sariputta says, when I've asked you each of these questions, you said no. And at the end of the paragraph, he says, oh, I'm sorry, coming back to paragraph 11, at the end of paragraph 11, after he gets the answer that none of these purifications could be identified with final nibbana without clinging, then he says, is final nibbana without clinging to be attained without these states, without these purifications? And then Puna answers, no, friend. Okay, so then in paragraph 12, Sariputta expresses puzzlement or perplexity. He says, each time you're asked, is this purification of that purification identical with final nibbana? You say no, but you also say that one cannot attain nibbana without this purification. So we can say that the seven purifications constitute the path, and final nibbana is the goal. And one has to use the path in order to attain the goal. Or you have to travel along the path in order to attain the goal. Okay, paragraph 13, Punamantani Putta is going to explain how to reconcile these two statements that none of the purifications is final nibbana, and yet one cannot attain the goal without these seven purifications. First, he says, if the Blessed One had described purification of virtue as final nibbana without clinging, then he would have described what is still accompanied by clinging as final nibbana without clinging. Here, the important word is upadana. Upadana literally means clinging. And then when it has the prefix sa, it means with clinging. But I have to say, I find it somewhat troublesome and a little perplexing myself why these seven purifications should be called sa upadana, with clinging. Since these are pure states that lead to the ending of clinging, that lead to nibbana. It might be the case, this is just a thought that occurs to me, that here upadana has a somewhat different meaning than it usually has in the texts. Usually upadana means like attachment or clinging to sensual pleasures, clinging to views, clinging to samsaric existence, clinging to the ideas of I and mine. In this case, this is my suspicion, but I'm not certain about it, that upadana doesn't mean clinging in that sense, but rather means with conditions, having, existing through conditions, depending upon conditions. And then final nibbana without clinging means both nibbana as the end of all clinging in the gross sense, clinging to sense pleasures, clinging to views, and also final nibbana as the state without conditions, the state that doesn't depend upon anything for its existence. In fact, the commentary to the Majjhima Nikaya explains, this is in note 289 in the back, on page 1215. The commentary explains anupada parinibbana, that's final nibbana without clinging, as apachaya parinibbana, which means final nibbana that has no condition. Then the commentary explains that upadana has two meanings. One meaning is grasping. That's in the usual passage on the four types of clinging. Clinging to sense pleasures, clinging to views, clinging to a doctrine of self, clinging to rules and rituals. Then the other meaning of upadana, according to the commentary, is condition, pachaya. Pachaya is the Chinese yuan. And this passage illustrates that meaning of upadana or clinging. Okay, now paragraph 13, going back to paragraph 13, the Buddha says, if the Buddha had described purification as virtue, purification of virtue is final nibbana without clinging, he would have described what is still su-upadana, what is still accompanied by clinging, as final nibbana without clinging. If the Buddha had described any of the other six purifications as final nibbana without clinging, he would have described what is still accompanied by clinging as final nibbana without clinging. Okay, so the path is not the goal, because the path is still accompanied by clinging, perhaps in the sense of based on conditions, and yet, and on the other hand, the goal is anupada, without clinging, without conditions. And yet, one has to use these stages of purification in order to reach the final goal. And Puna indicates this with the next statement. He says, if final nibbana without clinging were to be attained without these states, without depending on these seven purifications, then an ordinary person would already have attained final nibbana. For an ordinary person is without these states, without these purifications. So, if one didn't need the path to reach the goal, then one could just jump from our ordinary state to the goal, to nibbana, without having to travel along the path. Okay, and then Sariputta, Puna Mantaniputta illustrates this with a simile. He gives a simile referring to the king of the state of Kosala, King Prasenadi. And there's the capital city of the Kosala kingdom is Savati, and there's another important city some distance away called Saketa. So suppose King Prasenadi has to travel to Saketa. He travels by taking chariots from one to the other. And when he wants to travel, then there are relay points along the road from Savati to Saketa with chariots waiting for him. And so the king leaves Savati, mounts the first chariot, takes it a certain distance. When the horse gets tired, then the king gets down, gets onto the second chariot. The king gets down, mounts the second chariot, takes it some distance, gets down and mounts the third chariot, fourth, fifth, sixth, until he gets onto the seventh chariot. The seventh chariot takes him to the city of Saketa and takes him to the palace door. And so then his friends might ask him, did you travel from Savati to Saketa by means of this chariot that you're on now, that you just got off? And how would the king answer correctly? And then Sariputta gives the answer that the king would say, no, I didn't travel on this. I didn't come all the ways on this chariot, but rather at Savati, I mounted the first chariot, then I got off and got on the second chariot, all the ways till I reached the seventh chariot, and by means of that chariot, I arrived at the palace door of Saketa. And so then Puna gives the corresponding explanation. He says, purification of virtue is for the sake of reaching purification of mind. This is the key paragraph in the sutta. Purification of virtue, observing the precepts, purifying one's conduct, is for the purpose of reaching purification of mind, purifying the mind. Purification of mind is for the sake of reaching purification of you. Purification of you is for the sake of reaching purification by overcoming doubt. This is for the sake of reaching purification by knowledge of vision of what is the path and what is not the path. This is for the sake of reaching purification by knowledge and vision. I'm sorry. Yeah, this is for the sake of reaching purification by knowledge and vision of the way or practice. This is for the purpose of reaching purification of knowledge and vision. And purification by knowledge and vision is for the sake of reaching final nibbana without clinging. And this final nibbana without clinging, that is the purpose for which the spiritual life, the holy life, is lived under the Buddha. Okay, so here we have a very clear statement of these seven purifications and the goal towards which they are directed. Now the question comes up in the mind, what is meant by these seven purifications? And what's interesting and somewhat puzzling is that these seven purifications do not occur any place else in the Sutta Vitaka, but only in this sutta. And yet we find that this discussion is going on, and even though Sariputta is feigning ignorance at certain points, at the end, when he expresses his delight and appreciation for Punamantani Putta's answer, he actually says, Punamantani Putta is a learned disciple who understands the teacher's message correctly on the next page. And then he congratulates Punamantani Putta on his answer. And so it seems as if an understanding of these seven purifications was something shared by Sariputta and Punamantani Putta, as though they were both drawing from some fund of common knowledge. And yet nowhere else in the Sutta Pitaka does one find these seven purifications presented as a set. In the Anguttara Nikaya, the Anguttara Nikaya is organized by way of numerical schemes. So you have a group, many suttas dealing with one item, two items, three items, four items. And one big chapter is concerned with the sevens, groups of seven. And so one would expect to find there at least one sutta, if not several suttas, in which the Buddha says, there are, O monks, these seven purifications. What are the seven? Purification of you, purification of mind, and so on, up to purification of knowledge and vision. But one doesn't find any sutta like that there. In the Digha Nikaya, the last sutta, it's called the Dasutara Sutta. It's spoken by Sariputta as a kind of summary of the teaching. And it uses this numerical scheme, ones, twos, threes, fours. And in the nines in that sutta, one finds nine purifications. We find these seven purifications plus purification of wisdom, panya, parisuddhi, and purification of liberation. Now, this last sutta in the Digha Nikaya, because of its structure, we cannot say that all components of that sutta are equally early. It would be very easy to insert into that sutta some scheme that could have arisen somewhat later than the Buddha's own lifetime. And so I'm going to express a rather controversial and maybe heretical opinion. This is being taped. Probably, if this tape gets heard by the elders in Sri Lanka, if I try to go back there, visa denied. But I'll express my opinion that even though the sutta seems to be placed at an early time in the Buddha's career, that it didn't actually take place during the Buddha's own lifetime. But that, this is my suspicion, that the scheme of the seven purifications and the nine purifications arose at a somewhat later time than the Buddha's own lifetime, maybe a generation, two generations later. And the later purifications are just a way of subdividing the training in panya, in wisdom, into different stages. It could have been based, well based on the experiences of the meditating monks of that period. And yet that scheme was taking on a role of importance in interpretation and explanation of the Dhamma. And so the monks, or at least a group of monks, wanted to find some way to give it canonical authority. And so there may have been a story about a first meeting between Sariputta and Punamantaniputta, and about some conversation between them. And so they would have picked up that story and then used the seven purifications as the topic of their discussion, and in this way inserted the seven purifications into the canon itself. Another hypothesis, another possibility, that the seven purifications was not original to the Buddha himself, but was a scheme developed by Sariputta, not by the Buddha. And then other monks would have discussed the seven purifications, and Punamantaniputta would have heard about them. And so in this way, he came to know about them. And this discussion took place without having to ascribe these seven purifications to the Buddha. This would explain why there's no sutta that comes from the Buddha mentioning the seven purifications. The second explanation seems to me a little bit questionable, because if Sariputta had developed the seven purifications, we would expect to find in the canon a sutta in which Sariputta is giving a discourse on the seven purifications. But there is no such sutta. In the canon, we do find a sutta spoken by the Buddha where he mentions four purifications. This is the purification of virtue, purification of mind, and purification of view, the first three of the sevenfold scheme. And then, purification of liberation, which is the ninth amongst the nine purifications. But the other purifications we don't find elsewhere in the canon. Now, the scheme of seven purifications becomes extremely important in the history of Theravada Buddhism for a particular reason. For what reason is that? Anybody know? No. Exactly. It's the seven purifications is the scheme that structures the Visuddhimagga. And the Visuddhimagga is sort of the great treatise of the Theravada tradition, the great sort of encyclopedic, comprehensive attempt to incorporate all practices into one comprehensive scheme or presentation of the whole path. And it uses the seven purifications as its basic blueprint, as its plan. And then the Visuddhimagga gives us, based upon older commentaries, gives us explanations of the seven purifications. And I'll give very briefly the explanations of the Visuddhimagga. Then I'm going to be the rebellious heretic by rejecting the Visuddhimagga explanation and giving my own interpretation. Foolish fellow, but I think my explanation is correct. Okay, this is the way the Visuddhimagga explains the seven purifications. And of course, it's using a monastic framework. So purification of virtue means, especially, I'm going to be very concise, purifying the observance of the Patimokkha rules and of other aspects of sila, of virtuous conduct. Purification of mind is the attainment of the four jhanas, the four formless attainments, for those who follow the path of serenity, samatha, or it's something called momentary purification, for those who follow the path of, it's momentary, kanika samadhi, momentary concentration, for those who follow the path of dry insight meditation. Purification of view means that when the mind becomes clear and pure, one then directs this purified mind, temporarily purified mind, to examine the five aggregates and to see that what we call a person is just a composite of five aggregates, 12 sense bases, 18 elements, or just a compound of name and form, mental and material elements, nama-rupa. This expression, nama-rupa vavatana, means something like the definition of mentality and materiality. It means that one examines what one takes to be oneself and sees it's just a compound of name and form, and then one breaks the form up into the four elements and name into the four mental aggregates. And one is able to clearly distinguish them in one's meditation. Then the next purification, purification by overcoming doubt. Okay, the way Visuddhimagga explains this, after one distinguishes name and form, mentality and materiality, one examines how all of these mental and material factors arise from particular conditions. So this is called paccaya parigraha, which means understanding of conditions, understanding conditionality, grasping the conditioned nature of nama-rupa, of name and form. So one investigates the conditions for the body. One investigates the conditions for mentality. And then one applies dependent origination to the complex of mind and body. And one sees how this whole mind-body complex is dependently originated. Okay, following this comprehension of conditions, understanding of conditionality, one then starts to investigate the five aggregates in terms of the three characteristics: impermanence, suffering, non-self. First, one comprehends this in a general way. Then one goes into the examination of the rising and falling of phenomena. So one is able to distinguish how phenomena, bodily and mental phenomena, are constantly arising and passing away. And as one does so, as one's insight starts to get sharp, one experiences certain wonderful phenomena. Sometimes one's whole body becomes enveloped in bright light, and one experiences intense joy. The mind can become extremely tranquil. Sometimes one becomes very inspired and uplifted. And if one isn't careful, then one gets carried away by these wonderful and extraordinary phenomena, and one becomes attached to them. That is, according to the Visuddhimagga method, that is not the path, not the right way. The phenomena arise, but one should just go on observing them as impermanent, bound up with suffering, and non-self. That is the correct way. And so this is what is meant by knowledge and vision of what is the path and what is not the path. Okay, then one comes to, okay, after one goes through this distinction of the knowledge and vision of what is the correct path, what is not the path, one simply goes on contemplating the rise and fall of phenomena. And as one goes on contemplating the rise and fall of phenomena, then one passes through a series of deepening insights. One gets the insight into the three characteristics, becomes deeper, sharper, stronger. And all of these stages, these successive insights, are what is called knowledge and vision of the way. or knowledge and vision of the practice, Patipada Jnana Dasana. I think knowledge and vision of the practice is better translation than knowledge and vision of the way. Okay, when one's insight knowledge reaches its peak, its highest point, then one reaches the world-transcending path, the supramundane path. In the first case, the path of stream entry. And so for the Visuddhi Magga, Jnana Dasana Visuddhi, on the first time one reaches it, it's the path of stream entry. Then if one wants to go further to the higher stages, one doesn't have to go back all the ways to the beginning, but one goes back to the insight knowledges of Patipada Jnana Dasana Visuddhi, knowledge and vision of practice. Then one goes through the insight knowledges again, till one comes again to Jnana Dasana Visuddhi and reaches the second path and fruition. That's the stage of the once returner. Then one goes through the cycle a third time, one becomes a non-returner. And then one goes through it a fourth time and reaches the last stage, that's arhatship. Okay, I've just explained the Visuddhi Magga in less than 20 minutes. Okay, now, all of this elaborate explanation doesn't come from canonical texts, but it comes from the commentaries, and it comes from the experience of meditators through the centuries, or probably through from the early generations of the Buddhist era. And I'm not saying that it's a wrong scheme. It's actually an experiential scheme. But I'm just doubtful that that is the original significance of the seven purifications in the oldest texts. Okay, so let me explain my understanding now. Heresy, my heretical understanding. Okay, purification of virtue. Okay, I base this partly on Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya. This is, if anybody wants to check this, it's the collection of four, Sutta 194, which mentions four purifications. And for those of you who read Chinese, I found that there is a very brief explanation of the seven purifications in the Chinese text called Chang Shi Lun. I'll give you the reference. It's very brief, but what I can say about it is that it supports my interpretation. In this text, though it's preserved only in Chinese translation, it comes from another early tradition of Indian Buddhism. I mean, it was written either in the Sanskrit or probably in a classical Sanskrit and then translated into Chinese. Okay, so going back to the beginning. Okay, purification of virtue, purification of mind, no problem. There's nothing controversial there. When we come to purification of view, according to Anguttara Nikaya 4.194, purification of view is understanding as it really is the Four Noble Truths. And now we find repeatedly in the suttas, understanding the Four Noble Truths is the characteristic knowledge of the stream enterer. That is what marks the attainment of the stream of stream entry, is the insight, or rather it's the realization, the comprehension of the Four Noble Truths. So we could think of purification of view as being the triggering event which marks the attainment of stream entry. And maybe in a broader way, we might understand purification of view to be the whole process of purifying one's understanding to the point that one gains the wisdom that brings the attainment of stream entry. And that wisdom is the wisdom that comprehends the Four Noble Truths. Okay, then purification by overcoming doubt. Now, the stream enterer, abandons three fetters or cuts off three fetters. One is the fetter of identity view or view of self, the view that there's some self in the five aggregates. A second is the fetter of doubt, and a third is the fetter of clinging to rules and observances in the belief that they bring purification. And so the abandoning of doubt by the stream enterer seems to fit quite well with the purification by overcoming doubt. Okay, then there's no text which speaks about the purification by knowledge and vision of what is the path and what is not the path. Though there's some reference to knowledge and vision of what is the path and what is not the path in one somewhat obscure sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, where it said that the Buddha attains the various states of samadhi, but doesn't become attached to them. So, anyway, the stream enterer is one who has entered the stream of the path, one who has acquired the Noble Eightfold Path, one who possesses the Noble Eightfold Path. That is the stream that the stream enterer has entered. And so from this, it follows quite naturally that the stream enterer will be able to distinguish what is the correct path and what is not the correct path. And so it thus seems natural that when doubt is abandoned, then one can easily discriminate what is the path, what is not the path. And so the knowledge of overcoming doubt or purification by overcoming doubt would naturally be followed by knowledge and vision of what is the right path and what is not the path. Okay, then, once the person gains stream entry and can distinguish the right path and the wrong path, then he can enter very vigorously into the practice. And there are numerous texts which speak about the stream enterer as, uses the expression, a trainee who is engaged with the practice. And so this word patipatta connects with the word way here in the sixth purification. Patipatta jnana dasana visuddhi. And we also read very often about this. Seka is described as one who is patipanna. Patipanna is an adjective based on the noun patipada, way or practice. He's one described as practicing for liberation from birth, aging, and death. And so we could say that the purification by knowledge and vision of the way, this is the stage of one who is a stream enterer, once returner, or non-returner, and is continuing to practice for the ultimate goal. Then, this is again my understanding, purification by knowledge and vision, this would be the final knowledge, the final insight that culminates in arhatship. According to the scheme of the seven purifications, the purification by knowledge and vision is what culminates in reaching final nibbana without clinging. So it seems quite reasonable to take purification by knowledge and vision to be the knowledge, the insight, the wisdom that climaxes in the attainment of nibbana itself, or liberation. And so in this way, the seven purifications, it's not a series that one goes through four times in order to reach the final goal, but the seven purifications are the whole path ending in the final goal. Doesn't it seem reasonable? Let's take a vote on it. Okay, just to conclude the sutta, it's a nice conclusion. After Puna gives his explanation, Sariputta again feigns as though he doesn't know the identity of the monk in front of him. So he says, "What is your name?" And the monk says, "My name is Puna and my last name, Mantaniputta." Then Sariputta congratulates him on giving such an excellent and correct explanation. And then Puna asks the monk before him, he says, "What is your name? And how are you known?" And he says, "My name is Upatissa, and my last name is Sariputta." And then Puna is somewhat embarrassed by this, and he says, "I didn't know that I was talking to the Venerable Sariputta." He says, "The disciple who is like the master himself, like the Buddha himself." Sattu kapena savakena. That's the disciple who is the image in the image of the teacher. Then he says, "If I had known that you were Venerable Sariputta, I wouldn't have spoken so much." And then he congratulates Sariputta on his questions. And then he declares how honored he is to meet Sariputta. And with this, the sutta comes to an end. Okay, I've run a little over time tonight. But 16 minutes, it's the 16 minutes overtime, that was the sort of appendix, the the summary of the Visuddhimagga inserted into my talk. Okay, if there's any questions, please feel welcome to ask them. Don't be shy. Yeah.
Well, the seven purifications, as described in the Visuddhimagga, seem much more daunting than the latter description, which is familiar at least with the what I read in the sutras and as you described.
Okay, you say the system in the Visuddhimagga, it's much more daunting. I say it's daunting, I mean, not necessarily because of the scheme itself, but the Visuddhimagga uses the scheme of the seven purifications to try to fit in just about every aspect of the whole commentarial interpretation of the practice of the Dhamma. So you get like one purification, citta visuddhi, purification of mind, and it uses that. It takes a scheme of 40 subjects of meditation and it puts that into purification of mind, and then it explains each subject of meditation, some of them in quite extensive detail. Sometimes I have to say, very frankly, the explanations are so complex that it makes it difficult to practice. Whereas if one takes simpler methods of practice, then one doesn't have to be so complex in the explanation. And then when it comes to the development of wisdom, it takes the scheme of the 10 or 12 insight knowledges and incorporates that within the seven purifications. I mean, I have to say that the scheme of the insight knowledges, it's quite useful for laying out different sub-stages of experience. But if you just study it, it does seem daunting. Any further questions? Oh, I wanted to give the explanation of the seven purifications from the Chang Shilun. If I remember them correctly. I just found them a little bit before the class, a few minutes before the class. Purification of virtue. Jia Jing. That is pretty much the same as in the Pali, observing the rules of the Patimokkha. Xin Jing, purification of mind, is the attainment of chanting, of jhanic samadhi. Jianding, purification of view. It explains purification of view is the abandoning of Sakkaya Ditti, of Shanjian, the abandoning of identity view, personality view. Then it explains purification by overcoming doubt. I think it's Du I Ching? I'm not sure, but look it up. Purification by overcoming doubt, it explains as the abandoning of the fetter of doubt, which means that this is the stream enterer's elimination of doubt. Then it explains purification of what is the path and not the path as the abandoning of attachment to rules and observances. Chu Jia Duan, I think. Duan Chu Jia. Okay, then it explains, I have to say that one I don't find, seems a little bit artificial, that scheme. Not completely convincing, but so be it. Purification by practice, purification of the practice. I think it explains as the deepening of insight, the deepening of knowledge. And then the last one, it uses a somewhat different expression than the Pali. It wouldn't be translated purification by knowledge and vision, but maybe purification by knowledge and vision of abandoning. And then it explains that, I think, is the abandoning of defilements, the abandoning of all defilements, or maybe the abandoning of all the fetters, something like that. I didn't write down the explanation. Any further questions? Okay, if no questions, then we'll end for the evening. Please don't report me to the authorities. Maybe with a number under him, like a mugshot, wanted. Not dead or alive, since they can't kill in Buddhism, but wanted alive. ~1500 years of tradition, and this is what it comes to. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanam. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mang Parang. Etavataja Amehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sade Deva Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya. Etavataja Amehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Bhutanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya. Etavataja Amehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Sata Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya.